And it is today's Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, this hour we discuss the legalization of cannabis, or marijuana, in the United States. 20 states have legalized controlled medical usage. 2 have okayed restricted recreational use by adults. Joining us now is Steve Fox, who was instrumental in the Colorado deregulation movement. He's also the co-author, one of three, of the book Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? Steve Fox joins us from Bethesda, Maryland. Welcome to you, Steve Fox.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good afternoon. So let's begin with your victory in Colorado. I guess I have a couple of questions. How did you achieve it, and how's it working there in terms of where and how to buy it and taxes and regulation?
Sure. Well, how we got there, I guess, was a long story, but is connected to the book itself, which is in 2005, we launched a campaign, a public education campaign, to help educate the public that compared to alcohol, marijuana is actually a less harmful alternative, and there's no reason to punish adults who would prefer to use the less harmful of the two substances. And we spent years and years conducting that kind of education through ballot initiatives and other efforts to generate media coverage. We basically educated through the media and generated hundreds of stories about marijuana and alcohol and why people might prefer to use marijuana instead of alcohol. And this was based on an analysis of polling showing that those who understood that marijuana was less harmful than alcohol were more supportive of making it legal. So that led all the way to the campaign up in 2012, where we continued that kind of education and ran a campaign that ended with other messages, traditional messages saying that we shouldn't waste law enforcement resources and we should generate tax revenue for the state instead of having profits flow to Mexico and the underground economy. And the voters ended up supporting it at 55%, so it was a solid victory. And now we're at a point where possession and use is legal, and they're in the process of setting up the regulations for cultivation and sale. First legal sales for the adult market will be on January 1st in Denver and some other cities.
Okay. I read today that the Denver City Council is kind of embroiled in a controversy about wafting marijuana smoke. There could be fines. You can't use it in a public park. And technically, if you sat on your own front porch or back porch and used marijuana and it wafted into your neighbor's yard, they could call the police on you.
Yeah, that's very timely to bring up, and good that you noticed. That is something that was discussed in the Denver City Council yesterday, and our campaign considers it a real overreach. You mentioned the wafting smoke, which, you know, certainly is an issue itself, and we could debate that, but they went so far as to put in the ordinance that if you were even seen using marijuana in your house or on your front porch or whatever, that could be a criminal offense as well. So we have no doubt that if that ordinance were adopted, that it would be declared unconstitutional, as our measure was an amendment to the Constitution and clearly makes personal possession legal. So that will be fought out. But a number of city council members were already pushing back on that and talking about going back to the drawing board and figuring out a smarter way to do it. We do agree that people shouldn't be smoking in public parks and smoking on sidewalks and so on, but you need to find a fine balance, as people have done with alcohol. You can ban it in public parks and on sidewalks without telling people that they can't be seen through their window drinking a glass of wine.
Do you think that legalization in Colorado and Washington is the beginning of the end of prohibition of marijuana? Are other states taking steps toward legalization?
Yeah. I mean, I think regardless of Colorado and Washington, although it certainly created something of a tipping point, we've been moving in this direction for quite a while. I think the American people understand that it's a policy that's past its time. You see support growing significantly. I mean, since 2005, support across the nation has grown from about in the 30s or low 40s to the low 50s. So you now are seeing majority support across the country. So it's only a matter of time before it ends nationally. But in the short term, in addition to Colorado, you'll probably see a number of other states by 2016 making marijuana legal, which will include California, Washington State, maybe Nevada, Massachusetts, a few others. So the pace of change will begin to accelerate, I believe.
Well, here in Florida, purchasing or possessing more than 20 grams of marijuana is a third-degree felony, punishable with up to 5 years in prison, and less than that is a misdemeanor with a year possibility of prison.
Yeah, that really emphasizes, and what I'd really like to get to today when talking to you, is to really highlight how crazy that is, that we're really talking about people being punished with potentially long jail times for using a substance that is in every way less harmful than alcohol. And that's really what we're talking about. Someone may be morally opposed to marijuana use, or culturally opposed to marijuana use, and that may be an issue someone has. But the idea that we should put someone in jail for using a substance less harmful than alcohol is really insane.
We want to get to all the ways it's less harmful than alcohol that you contend, but are there efforts afoot on the congressional level to provide relief from the stiff penalties?
In the congressional level, I mean, what we've seen from the Department of Justice in the bigger picture, they had to respond to Colorado and Washington making it legal. They were getting a lot of pressure to say what the federal government's response would be, and what they ended up saying, they put out a memo at the end of August. The Deputy Attorney General, James Cole, issued a memorandum to all U.S. attorneys saying, if individuals are complying with state laws and are acting in accordance with those laws, that the federal government will have it as a low priority to go after those people. And in fact, the language suggested more that they would not go after those people, essentially giving the green light to Colorado and Washington to move forward.
Would legalization incur more widespread use of marijuana?
I don't know about widespread, but I certainly think, if you just think anecdotally, I'm sure anyone listening today knows someone, if it's not themselves personally, who may have used marijuana in college or whenever and may have enjoyed it. But because of the laws that we have, because of employment policies that there are, they just don't use it anymore. And then when they want to relax after work, they have a beer, a wine, or a cocktail, or whatever. But once it's legal across the country, I fully expect that some people like that might choose to relax with a little marijuana after work or before bed or whatever. So I think there will be more use. But I don't know if I would call it widespread, and the idea that people are going to be crazy on the streets probably won't happen.
Can employers in Colorado, where it's now legal to recreationally use marijuana, still fire people who flunk a drug test?
Yeah, they may. They may. We didn't want to be in a position, and I was part of the team that drafted the initiative and ran the campaign. We didn't want to have this campaign be about forcing employers to have people on the job who may have used marijuana. Of course, we believe that work, I mean, use unrelated to work, whether it's the night before, the weekend before, or whatever, certainly shouldn't be an issue. But we weren't going to tell employers that they had to change their policies. We just believe that the first step was making it legal for adults to use it. And then I think it will be difficult for employers to maintain policies that have a blanket ban on use, like any positive test, but obviously there'll be certain jobs, maybe many jobs, where employers don't want people using marijuana just before they come to work, just like they wouldn't want people drinking on the job. So there'll be policies related to that, but eventually we do need to get rid of the policies that would punish an employee for using marijuana on Friday night and then coming into work on Monday and testing positive.
How long does it stay in your system?
It can be weeks.
Okay.
It really does. 14 days is pretty common for use, at least have traces of it. There's active THC in your system, which is generally out of your system, maybe after 24 or 48 hours tops. But then there are the metabolites that stay in the system and take a long time to get out of the system. And many employer drug testing policies are testing for metabolites because that's what appears in urine. It's the metabolites, the active THC you only detect in blood.
Steve Fox, what first got you into this legalization move that you've devoted so much time to?
Well, I guess I had a personal interest for a long time. I was down in D.C. doing more political policy work, and this was back in 2001, where I just left a job and happened to see an opening for the Marijuana Policy Project to do some lobbying for them, and I thought it would be interesting and pursued the opportunity, and I've been doing it for 11 years now.
Are you a regular user?
I've certainly used it in the past, and when it is legal where I live, I certainly will use it, but unfortunately it's currently illegal in Maryland.
We're speaking with Steve Fox. He's the co-founder with Mason Tvert of SAFER, an acronym for Safer Alternative for Enjoyable Recreation. He's the co-author with Mason Tvert. Is that how you pronounce his name, Mason Tvert?
It is. Yep.
Okay. And Paul Armentano of Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? On today's Topical Currents. When we come back, I want to talk about now the safety versus the alcohol. But let's take a short break and we'll be right back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman and Joseph Cooper here. We're visiting with Steve Fox, co-founder of SAFER and co-author of Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? If you want to join in the conversation, a question or comment for Steve, the number is 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Our email is radio at WLRN.org. Our Twitter is not working today. So let's consider why marijuana is safer than alcohol, beginning with statistics on toxicity and overdose. You say that while people can drink lethal doses of alcohol, we can't smoke fatal doses of cannabis. Why not?
Well, I'm not sure I can get deeply into the scientific side of why not, but it has been studied and has been seen over time that there simply isn't a fatal amount of marijuana that can be consumed. It's essentially non-toxic to the body. So you could have quite a lot, and you know, it may make you sleepy and feel like going to sleep, but it's not damaging to the body. And the difference with alcohol is that when you talk about the effective dose to fatal dose, or it's usually described as the fatal to effective dose ratio, for alcohol, just 10 times what one might enjoy for just relaxation or recreational purposes or whatever, 10 times that could be a fatal dose. So we see that all the time. It's familiar probably to everyone listening to the program that there are times when people have a fatal overdose. There are other times where people have just a little too much alcohol and end up throwing up, which is, you know, a sign of the toxicity as well, the body responding to the toxicity. And that just doesn't exist for marijuana.
And what about diseases? We know, like, cirrhosis of the liver, and I guess it's associated with some forms of cancer. What about marijuana?
Yeah, well, I can only point to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, and that's the best way to judge this. And they track this kind of thing, and what they found is that between 30 and 35,000 Americans die every year from the health effects of alcohol. That doesn't include traffic accidents and other accidents. But for marijuana, the number is zero. It basically has no association with morbidity. Every study that's been done has shown that. You know, there's always been people talking about, and even the federal government has vigorously done this in the past, and talk about the number of carcinogens that marijuana has, suggesting that it would lead to lung cancer or other forms of cancer. But the largest study ever done to see the effects of marijuana on lung cancer, where they studied, this was at UCLA, where they studied tobacco and marijuana use. And what they found is that obviously tobacco had an association with lung cancer, but there was no association with marijuana and lung cancer. And in fact, those who used tobacco and marijuana had a lower incidence of lung cancer than those who only used tobacco.
I read some statements by police officers saying that they never have to go break up a domestic violence situation because of the smoking of marijuana, but frequently it's because of alcohol use.
Yeah, that's certainly another point we make in the book and publicly, which is that there is that association with violence, with alcohol, and we see it all the time. I mean, I opened up the Washington Post this morning, and there was a story about two friends, and one friend killed the other friend, who was a Georgetown law student, because they had been drinking, and one thought the other was, with his girlfriend, and that resulted in one killing the other, and then you saw an alcohol-fueled riot up in Bellingham, Washington State over the weekend at one of the schools there, with hundreds of people who had been drinking, throwing bottles at police cars and so on. And it's just a fact of life, and most people know that. And again, given the fact that alcohol is frequently associated with acts of violence, you know, we find it just ridiculous that people who would prefer to use marijuana and prefer to be around marijuana users would be punished for that.
Are there any figures on prescription drug abuse, what that incident rate might be, a ballpark figure?
I will be honest and say that I don't have those figures in front of me. I'm always talking about marijuana and alcohol and don't have the exact figures. But I know, that's widespread. Prescription drug accidental overdoses are in the tens of thousands, I believe. I mean, you look at a substance just like Tylenol, and Tylenol has a few hundred accidental deaths every year, often, interestingly, when used in combination with alcohol due to its impact on the liver. But sure, I mean, there are all kinds of prescription drugs that are far, far more dangerous than marijuana.
What about, getting back to the smoking aspect of it, is it not harmful to the lungs and respiratory system the way cigarettes are?
Inhaling any kind of smoke isn't good and can irritate the bronchial tubes and the throat, but it hasn't been shown to lead to any forms of cancer, if that's the concern. And for those who are concerned about irritating their throat by smoking, it's very easy to use a vaporizer. Nowadays, in Colorado, from what I understand, they've had a fully regulated medical marijuana market there for 3 years now. And what they've seen, now that the free market has taken over, is that about 40% of their sales are through pocket vaporizers. So people are smoking a lot less, which is not surprising.
How does the vaporizer thing work? I'm a novice.
Sure. People have probably seen e-cigarettes. Mm-hmm. where you have a nicotine, the nicotine in a liquid, basically in an oil, and it sort of looks like a pen, and it has a heating element, and it basically turns that oil into a vapor that you inhale, so you're inhaling more of a mist than smoke. So it's similar for marijuana. They create concentrates with the marijuana and infuse it into an oil or some other liquid substance, and then that is vaporized.
So it doesn't combust.
Yeah.
It doesn't, that's right. It doesn't.
Why is today's marijuana considered to be so much more potent than years ago?
They're basically growing it to be stronger. Some people consider that alarming, but the point is that if people use marijuana that is more potent or stronger, they will just use less of it. It's more efficient to grow marijuana that has a higher THC content, And just as people know the difference between vodka and beer, and they wouldn't have a 12-ounce glass of vodka, but they would have a 12-ounce beer, it's the same thing. When people know that it's stronger, then they just have less.
What about the addictive or addiction? How some people say because it's more potent, it's more addictive. How do you respond to that?
That just, it hasn't been seen.
Okay.
In terms of addiction, it hasn't really been shown that marijuana is physically addictive, but it does seem to be, for some people, habit-forming. Just the same way some people really enjoy playing video games, and they end up playing video games a lot, and maybe too much, and aren't as productive as they could be otherwise. It's more like that, because if you have someone who's using a lot of marijuana and then has to stop immediately, maybe because they've been arrested, maybe they're going to treatment, maybe their employer threatens to fire them if they use marijuana anymore and they have to stop, people do it, and it's not like there's withdrawal. They may get a little irritable. They may have some trouble sleeping because the marijuana may have helped them sleep, especially for people who have anxiety and so on. But you don't have the same sort of physical withdrawal, which is typically associated with addiction, the kind of thing you see with alcohol and prescription drugs and so on.
Which can be lethal, alcohol withdrawal. Isn't that correct?
Indeed, yeah. Yeah, in its extreme, it definitely can be.
Let's take a quick phone call before our break. This is Janelle in West Palm Beach.
It's Janelle in West Palm Beach, and thank you for bringing up the elephant in the room, the addiction aspect of this. I do know my numbers, and marijuana is about 9% of the population does become addicted, compared to about 10% of the general population over 21 with alcohol and other drugs. That's comparable. But when it comes to adolescents, that number goes up to 45%. And I'm a parent who's got a child in recovery. My 15-year-old son is 15 months sober. And his drug of choice was marijuana, which he started smoking at age 13. Now, I know you can all agree this is for adult use, but the reality is when there's a perception that it's okay, kids use. And treatment and recovery are expensive. So while I'm not diabolically opposed to marijuana legalization, I want to know what percentage of the tax dollars are going into prevention to keep kids under the age of 21, but especially under the age of 14, from beginning use at all, because it massively impairs cognitive development. And I can say my son's treatment to date, full cost of it has been over $100,000, of which we've paid out of pocket about half.
Steve?
Sure, and that's a difficult issue, and I definitely appreciate the call and really appreciate having the opportunity to talk about the youth aspect, because that is important, and obviously when we're trying to change the laws, we're only making it legal for adults, so we're not really changing whether it's legal or not for youth, and in fact, where it's been regulated in Colorado since 2009 under the medical system, they've seen an 11% drop in teen use. So the regulated nature may be helping along those lines. But the truth is that obviously Janelle's son used marijuana while it was illegal, and youth today have access to marijuana. And that's just the fact. It's not like keeping it illegal is changing that. But what we need to do is make sure that we educate teens. Janelle asked about how much money has been spent, and the federal government spent literally billions of dollars during the 2000s on an anti-drug media campaign that was primarily focused on marijuana. And the question that I would ask all parents to think about is how much education is being done encouraging their kids not to use alcohol. There tends to be this emphasis on marijuana prevention, and people treat alcohol as if it's, just something that kids are going to do. And the point is that it's far more dangerous, and very few kids end up in treatment for marijuana. Some do, and it's certainly not great when they do, and we hope they get the treatment they need. But alcohol could actually lead to their death if they overdose. Drunk driving is a major problem, and so on. So we just have to educate our kids about all substances and not create this impression that marijuana is somehow worse and that alcohol is okay.
Does deregulation maybe put some of the two-bit dealers out of business?
Oh, indeed. Yeah. And we don't call it deregulation. We actually call it regulation, because what we have in most of the country right now is a completely uncontrolled and unregulated market. So what our campaign in Colorado was actually called the campaign to regulate marijuana like alcohol. So we're trying to regulate it, control it, make sure that people who sell it have to check IDs, that they'll go out of business if they allow teens to purchase it, and it will make it so that the underground dealers who don't check IDs will be put out of business.
Staying on the subject of the teens, what about the gateway theory? We've heard about this for ages regarding marijuana, that it leads to the use of harder drugs. Is that a myth? Has that been dispelled, or is that true?
Yeah, no, it has been dispelled, and I would encourage anyone to look it up. The RAND Corporation, which is one of the most respected research organizations and certainly entirely neutral on this issue, sort of debunked that myth. And I actually am pleased when that subject is brought up, because, again, this is an important issue about teen health and so on. And the only gateway that exists right now is the fact that we have marijuana sold in the same markets as other drugs. It's not that marijuana use, like, changes your physical nature in some way that leads you to use other drugs, but we have people who feel that marijuana should remain illegal, remain in the criminal market, even though they know 50% of teens will try marijuana before they graduate high school, which means that 50% of teens are somehow exposed to the illegal market, which then leads them to possibly being exposed to the harder drugs that could do serious damage to them. You know, if people go to buy marijuana, they might be offered heroin or cocaine or something like that. But if they get their hands on alcohol, it's probably from an older sibling or older friend, and that friend isn't saying, okay, here's your six-pack, would you also like some heroin? You know, we need to break the link between marijuana and the truly harmful drugs so that that connection doesn't exist anymore.
Let's go back to our callers. This is Lewis in Lauderhill. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm an old guy with who had three spinal surgeries. As a result, I have nerve damage, and I currently have to take Neurontin in order to calm my nerves down. It keeps me up at night if I don't take it. I would like to have a prescription for medical marijuana, but my neurologist tells me it's not available in Florida because of the state law. Does the guest have a view on that?
First of all, I'm sorry for your health condition. I know how bad that can be, and unfortunately, and I say unfortunately because of the way the laws are, marijuana has been shown to be helpful with neuropathic pain and similar conditions like that. But no, it isn't legal right now in Florida. There is one group that's trying to get it on the ballot for 2014. I'm honestly not sure where they are in that process, if they're going to make it on the ballot or not. It would also need 60% of the vote to be adopted. But there's an attempt to put it on the ballot. So we'll see. I can't say much more than that, but that's what we're pleased about in Colorado and Washington, in addition to many of the medical marijuana states, of course. Those who do have that kind of pain and need marijuana to alleviate their symptoms are able to do that legally now.
Very disturbing. Thank you.
Okay. Yep.
Thank you for calling. Laura said, please ask you to comment on Canada's just announced and widely reported landmark marijuana licensing and legalization initiative.
Yeah, that's right. For a long time up in Canada, they were, they had a government-run system, and they had a government-licensed entity that was producing marijuana for medical patients. But what they did recently is just open that up. They decide they don't want to basically be in charge anymore, so they're just opening it up to the private sector to apply for licenses to grow and provide marijuana for patients.
Why has President Obama been so reluctant to support relaxation of cannabis laws?
Well, I can only say it's political. I mean, he's someone who, from his own personal and extensive experience, knows that marijuana is not a demon drug, and that it's something that people use to relax and spend time with their friends and have a good time and so on. So that's well documented. But, you know, being in office, I guess that changes one's perspective or their ability to do what they might normally do under different circumstances. That said, I do give the administration credit for allowing Colorado and Washington to move forward with these historic new laws, because we will see over time that society is better off with marijuana regulated and controlled and taxed and so on. And by allowing Colorado and Washington to show the rest of the country, and in fact the rest of the world, we're seeing incredible movement. Mexico City is now considering controlling and regulating marijuana. The country of Uruguay is close to making it legal, where the state or the country would actually be selling it. So Colorado and Washington have really led to a reexamination of policies across the globe, and it's good that they're being allowed to proceed.
Sam, you will ask how the prohibition of marijuana has been exacerbated by interests involved in industries that could be damaged by hemp production.
We haven't seen too much of that. I know that's something that's sort of bandied about sometimes, as if like the DuPont Corporation or others may have been responsible at first, and other companies like that may wish for marijuana and hemp to remain illegal. But up to this point, really the biggest opponents, or I would say the largest industry opposed to making marijuana legal, good guess.
Oh.
It's actually the law enforcement industry, which people don't think of as an industry. But there's a lot of money, billions of dollars every year spent on marijuana prohibition, and it funds law enforcement jobs, it funds law enforcement resources and tools like new helicopters and you know, trucks and so on, and pays for overtime for their jobs. It's just there's a lot of money involved in marijuana prohibition, and what you see is mostly law enforcement being the ones who are opposing this.
Bail bonds, attorneys.
Sure. I mean, there are even, private prison industries and so on. I mean, there's up and down the line. That's where all the money is going right now.
That's so ironic, because the former police chief of Seattle wrote the foreword to your book.
That's correct. Yeah. And he's part of a group called LEAP, which is Law Enforcement Against Prohibition.
Oh.
And those are law enforcement officials who are willing to stand up and say the war on drugs isn't working, we're wasting billions of dollars, we should take more of a public health approach to the drug problem.
Let's take another caller. This is Jared in West Palm Beach. Hi.
Hi, how are you all doing today?
Okay.
Good.
Hey, good. I did have a question similar to another caller, but I would like to make a comment that I do agree. There's probably a lot of people in their 40s, 50s, 60s that would probably smoke a little bit or recreationally if it was legalized. And they have a lot of fear out there, as myself, that, you know, I've got two children, I got a family, you know, house to support. It's just not worth the chance to take because my job randomly drug tests. But it's kind of like ironic that we have to be forced into not having a recreational thing that we could do because of this fear. But what could we do in Florida? Like, what is happening that we could put together something that will start the process of legalization?
I think you're going to have a really tough road.
Yeah.
yeah, it is an uphill climb. And most likely, Florida is just going to eventually ride the wave of reform as other states across the country end up making it legal, realize that the sky doesn't fall, and generate millions of dollars in tax revenue, all states will want to get on board. I mean, for example, Colorado in the current fiscal year, just through the medical marijuana system, is going to have $300 million in legal sales, which are going to produce, I think, about $12 to $15 million in tax revenue for the state and cities.
What's the tax rate in Colorado, say, for an ounce of cannabis? And what does it cost to buy that ounce, say?
Yeah, well, an ounce of marijuana, because of the free market and so on, and not having to deal with the criminal nature of marijuana, the price of marijuana in Colorado has dropped from probably about $400 an ounce, and now it's $200 an ounce that you would just buy in a store, and that's, you know, usually tested and good quality and so on. So quality is improved and price has dropped. And some people are starting to sell it even lower than that. The tax right now on medical is just standard state sales and local sales tax rates. But the non-medical marijuana, which they'll start selling on January 1st, there will be other taxes on the state level. There'll be an additional 15% excise tax and an additional 10% sales tax, plus there will likely be some local taxes as well. So probably an additional 20 to 25% tax, but still far, far cheaper than what it would have been in the criminal market.
We have to take a break, but Stacy wants to know about studies correlating pot use with schizophrenia in later years. Are you familiar with those?
There's some evidence. So if you're asking me to answer now, it's been discussed, and possibly for those who are predisposed to having schizophrenia, meaning they're probably going to get it eventually, the marijuana can be a trigger. But in terms of marijuana actually causing schizophrenia out of the blue, there's really no evidence for that. And part of the evidence countering that is the fact that rates of schizophrenia in society really haven't changed over time in the big picture, even as marijuana became far more popular and far more widely used. So it doesn't seem like it causes it, but for those who would probably have developed it anyway, it can be a trigger.
And it can be a trigger in younger years as well?
If you're talking about people who would have developed it anyway, perhaps, yeah. I'm not sure the exact evidence, but I have seen some studies that lead you to believe that using it, you know, could result in, you know, earlier onset than otherwise.
We're speaking with Steve Fox. He's co-founder of Safer, and he's the co-author of Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? We need to take another break, and we'll be back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're rejoined by Steve Fox. We're talking about legalization of cannabis. I'm told that the Florida Cannabis Action Network is the local organization that's active on this issue. Florida Cannabis Action Network is the local organization active on the issue, so you can Google that if you'd like.
Okay, and emailer James Jim wants to know what the difference is medically and otherwise between use of marijuana and THC.
Well, marijuana is one of the cannabinoids in marijuana. It's the one that's most commonly known. It's the one that really causes the intoxication that one feels using marijuana. But there are many other cannabinoids in marijuana. Another prominent one is CBD, which is cannabidiol. And there's really exciting research on that, showing that it really has effective medical properties, and it's CBD that is really sort of the pain relief part of marijuana. And then there are a number of other cannabinoids in the plant. And there's also an interaction between the two. If THC and CBD are combined, the CBD can offset the intoxicating effects of the the THC. So anyway, it's a plant that deserves a lot more study. Unfortunately, a lot of effective medical research studies have been blocked by the government. So a lot will be learned over time, but we're just starting to learn the potential of the plant. I mean, it's been shown to slow the progression of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's in some studies, to slow the growth of cancerous tumors, maybe even reverse some cancers, and so on. There are really a number of medical benefits.
Can people who want medical marijuana, can they get that in a capsule form?
You mean legally?
Yeah. Or illegally.
Yeah. I mean, in Colorado, they now sell it in capsule form, and I believe they also do in California, where there's a pretty sizable market. There are tinctures that you can put drops under your tongue. There are the vaporizers I talked about earlier, capsules, edibles, candies, so on, really everything. But outside of Colorado, obviously you're limited. There's Marinol, which is just THC. That's a prescription drug. It's synthetic THC, in fact. But as I just mentioned before, THC is just what gets you intoxicated. I mean, it does have some medical properties as well, but it can be very potent on its own. So, and then there's another drug called Sativex, which is created by GW Pharmaceuticals in England, which is whole plant extracts that you spray under your tongue. And that's currently going through the FDA approval process and could be available in the United States by early 2015. It would be approved for people with cancer pain, maybe MS as well, and then there could be perhaps other off-label uses once it's legal.
Let's take another caller. This is Alexandra in Miami. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I started smoking when I was 20. I recently stopped smoking. I was smoking for 14 years, and it didn't really stop me from being a productive member of society. I have lots of friends who smoke, but I do believe that I'm part of a very small percentage of people who are in a way, or were in a way, addicted to pot. And it did affect me because it exposed me to a criminal environment that I did not want to be a part of. It created a habit that I was not happy with, and it really is a nasty habit to have. So I stopped smoking, but trying to stop, I looked into finding ways to help me, and I didn't. I did not find anywhere that I could go to, or even online, ideas or suggestions about quitting or how to quit. So it's been very hard for me to do it, to be honest, and it's also not really accepted in society within my friends, I noticed. So then it seems so weird to hear that I want to quit. So I understand that it's a better, if you look at it as, you know, as a drug, in a better way than going into alcohol or any other heavy drugs. I don't drink, for example, so for me, it was more of a way to keep me calmer, and I'm a very hyper person, so it kept me a lot calmer. But I didn't like to be attached to a habit, and that's the part that it started bothering me. And I don't know, I would like to hear something about maybe helping people that do want to quit. Where would people go?
Steve?
Yeah, I would like to say that I have a good answer to that, but I really, you know, don't have off the tip of my fingers, you know, where one might go. I would say that most likely it would be to either a drug treatment center, obviously, would be a logical choice. It could also be a therapist, because oftentimes people who are using marijuana with great frequency, it's not necessarily physical addiction, but it's related to maybe some other issues they might have, nothing necessarily major, but some other issues, like this caller was talking about having anxiety. And obviously, there are millions and millions of Americans who are taking anti-anxiety drugs, and that is considered normal. But when people use marijuana to try to alleviate their anxiety, such as those who need to use it before going to bed because it helps them sleep, I mean, that there shouldn't be anything wrong with that. I mean, it's very effective as an anti-anxiety drug, and it does help people sleep, and it's basically without any significant harms when used in a limited manner. or even used in not a limited manner. But anyway, it's it shouldn't be any different from Xanax and so on. I mean, we live in a strange society where alcohol and prescription drugs are wonderful and marijuana is somehow bad and should be illegal.
We have an email from Karen Goldstein. She's the director of NORML of Florida, which stands for National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. And she said the petition for medical marijuana is www.unitedforcare.org. And that they actively support the petition.
We'll put that link on our website and Facebook page.
Yeah, unitedforcare.org. Okay, thanks for writing, Karen. And wait a minute. Pat wants to know if you can take a vacation in Colorado and have a doctor's visit if he writes a prescription and buy it while you're on vacation for medical marijuana.
But bringing it across state lines is another story.
Yeah. Well, the beauty of it is, I say from that emailer's perspective, is that as of January 1st, you could just go to Colorado. It'll be legal for any adult over the age of 21, so you don't need a medical card or anything like that.
Oh, so but you can't bring it back over other state lines.
Well, that's correct. I mean, once you enter another state, it will be as illegal as before. It won't be, if you bring it back to Florida and you're caught with it in Florida, you will be punished under Florida law. But you can certainly purchase it at a store in Colorado and enjoy it while you're on vacation and then leave it there, I guess.
Right. Well, we've been speaking with Steve Fox. He's co-founder with Mason Tverd of Safer Alternative for Enjoyable Recreation. And he's the co-author with Mason Tverd and Paul Armentano of Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And thanks for listening. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and other programs at our website, WLRN.org. More information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page, including associated links. And tomorrow at 1 o'clock, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade County School Board meeting. And to the calendar, on this day, 1920, 93 years ago, the birth of author Mario Puzo in New York's Hell Kitchen. The Godfather was published in 1969 after Puzo had spent years writing in pulp fiction. The film was made in 1972. And on this day in 1946, 67 years ago, the suicide of Nazi Gestapo founder and Luftwaffe commander Hermann Göring in Nuremberg on the eve of his hanging execution for war crimes. Potassium cyanide had been smuggled to him. Göring was the highest-ranked Nazi Party member tried at Nuremberg. And one more while we remember the Mertzes and the Ricardos. On this day in 1951, 62 years ago, the premiere of I Love Lucy on CBS. The comedy was produced for 6 years. Reruns are still seen. So we leave with a thought from Mario Puzo, who died in 1999 at age 78. Quote, "There is no greater natural advantage in life than having an enemy overestimate your faults, unless it was to have a friend underestimate your virtues." Stay with us. Next hour, it's Here and Now from NPR News.